Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, February 24th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Healthcare is one of America's toughest, most stubborn issues. Why is it so hard to build a system that actually works for everyone? That's the question we're taking on today in the second episode of our monthly Big Fix series, where we hash out solutions to some of the country's biggest problems.
Let's hash. You probably know that the U.S. spends more on health than any other country, $5.3 trillion and counting. But health outcomes don't necessarily match that investment. Compared to similar countries, we have higher child mortality, more preventable death, and a lower life expectancy.
And for millions of Americans, care is still out of reach. Nearly half say they've had to choose between medical care and basic living necessities, and more than a third report skipping or postponing medications or treatment because of cost.
So today we've gathered a panel of experts and asked them to come to the table, the literal table, with two big ideas for fixing the system, whether that means rebuilding it from the ground up or making more subtle reforms. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is an oncologist and key architect of the ACA and vice provost for global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also author of the new book, Eat Your Ice Cream. Zeke, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Wonderful.
Also, we have with us Dr. Marion Mass, a practicing pediatrician in Bucks County and board member of Free to Care. Marion, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, we have Wendell Potter, who is a former health insurance executive, president of the Center for Health and Democracy, and author of the Substack, Healthcare Uncovered. Thank you so much for being back on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. We want your big fix ideas. How would you make healthcare better in America? The number to call to participate is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, put those ideas in the live chat.
All right, Dr. Marion Mass, we wanted to start with your first big idea, and it's about following the money in healthcare as a public exercise. So break this down. What's the idea and what problem is it solving?
So when we, you guys referenced it in your opening, everyone tells me, whether they're my patient, they're my friend, they're my colleagues, we're all getting less, we're all paying more. Mm. The money is going somewhere. And it's been said again and again that healthcare is not at all transparent. We can't really see where the money is going, whether it's going to Medicaid, Medicaid managed care, Medicare, Medicare Advantage programs, or even the most common way that most people get healthcare outside of Medicare is through their employers, right? Mm. So I think what we really need is a big fiscal audit. Mm. You know, I think a lot of people, it sounds like a bad way to put it, but a lot of people feel like healthcare is a big cartel right now. Mm. Mm. And, you know, you watch that movie, The Untouchables. Let's take us back to the movies. You watch the movie, The Untouchables. How did they get to Al Capone? They got to the bookkeeper. Mm. We need a big bookkeeper.
So I want to read this comment from Naomi, who I think is thinking along similar lines. Naomi says, I'm a mom of six kids and a physician. One of the hardest parts about dealing with healthcare is it's so confusing. I have a hard time checking prices or shopping for the best deals for my family. I see my patients being charged many different rates for similar procedures. I've seen pharmacy access decrease, and I feel like it's only gotten worse since the ACA was passed, even though healthcare is one-fifth of our GDP. So Naomi agrees that it's confusing. We need some transparency. But what would that look like, Mary? And I mean, we talk about an audit, and, you know, my eyes start to glaze over a little bit just with the word audit. What do you think you could find with an audit? How would it lead us towards solutions?
Well, actually, one of the things that I like to tell people that I find very comforting is there is a lot going on that's happening across the aisle. So, for instance, when I reference transparency, there's a bill in the Senate. It's called the Patients Deserve Price Tags Act. Mm-hmm. And this this kind of mandates the kind of transparency that we're talking about. One particular portion of that bill that I want to address, 61% of Americans that are not on Medicare get their health care through their employers. Those employers, if they're self-funded, they can't even see exactly what they're paying. Mm. This changes that, and that's really important. And it's an across-the-aisle bill. Hickenlooper of Colorado and Roger Marshall of Kansas. These are an R and a D, and they're agreeing, and that's a beautiful thing.
And a big issue that I've seen is that, you know, we've all been patients at some point. A lot of times you don't even know how much, you know, things cost when you go to the doctor mm-hmm. until after you get the services. Are you advocating for even patient transparency, that we know what we're being charged in advance for different services?
Absolutely. I mean, there are people who argue that, oh, there's certain things that we can't shop for. Like if I'm in a car wreck driving home, or if I have a sudden right lower quadrant abdominal pain and have an appendicitis, I may not be able to shop for that, right?
Right.
But I think it's less than 1% of all health care is unshoppable.
No, that's definitely not true.
No, so let's go to that, because the question of price transparency goes mm-hmm. to a bigger question, right? Which is this idea that a market could be more efficient if we actually knew what we were buying or deciding not to buy. Now, there's some problems with that with healthcare, as Marion pointed out, because some healthcare you just need, whether or not it costs a certain amount, you need it right now, or maybe you need it in the next week because you have a life-threatening illness and there's only one course of treatment. So it's a little trickier with healthcare. What do you think about price transparency?
I think price transparency is easy. Everyone likes it. But it's not actually a solution. We've had price transparency experiments, whether through employers or states, like New Hampshire had a price transparency tool and didn't work.
Why wouldn't it work, though? It seems like a very obvious, yeah.
Most people don't shop. Most people who use it actually aren't needing health care at that time. They're just sort of curious. And when they need health care, people don't rely solely on price, because price isn't the only thing you care about. You also care about quality
and sure.
They're differentiate, they're separate. So let me just say, I am all for price transparency. Who would be against price transparency? Mm-hmm. I get the bills. They're outrageous. I've had lots of bills. I could go on and on about stories where an insurance company actually paid $2,000, more than $2,000 sure. over the price charged.
Wow.
And the other thing we should mention is there's not a single price. Okay, not. Mm-hmm. You go to University of Pennsylvania Hospital, and what they end up charging, what ends up being the price,
sure.
varies by the insurance company, varies by the employer. There's just not one price. So you tell me what the price is. I have no idea. Who's paying? That points to a critical problem in the American healthcare system, mm-hmm. which is we need two principles to guide all future decisions. One principle is simplicity. It has to be simplified. Mm-hmm. Don't add on more complexity. And I think in some aspects of the Affordable Care Act, we violated that principle. We added exchanges, which made the system more complicated actually to get coverage. This other is standardize. Don't have each individual insurance company doing something different. That adds hugely to administrative costs. There are other countries with lots of different insurance companies. Germany has about 100. They're called sickness funds there. But they're all standardized. Standardized price schedules, standardized coverage. That yeah. makes it a lot more efficient.
Now,
let me just finish
yeah.
one idea.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That goes to actually reducing the administrative costs, which in the American system are outrageously high. They're 20% of all spending is administrative costs, and they are way higher than every other country.
Yeah.
And if we simplified things and standardized them, you could actually bring those administrative costs way down.
And let's bring in a caller. We have Mike from Bucks County. He's talking about the issue that you raised, Marion. Mike, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
It's about transparency, and thank you for taking my call. Why can't we see where the money's going, and why is so much of it hidden?
Yeah. Mike from Bucks County is asking the same question. It feels like, and Marion, I want to give you a chance to respond, and then Wendell, feel free to chime in on this before we move on to our next big fix. Yeah,
Wendell, do you want to go first before I?
Sure. Yeah, the reason is because it's to the insurance industry's and hospitals' providers' interest for price transparency not really to exist. In fact, in most insurance contracts that they negotiate with hospitals and providers, they insist on secrecy. They say it is a competitive advantage for them, or it's a competitive issue that they
right.
they say you can't disclose that. So this obscurity creates the situation we have now. It adds to the complexity. And
could we legislate our way out of that, though?
Do
you think we could mandate some sort of price transparency that would indeed lead to different choices by consumers.
Well, I agree with Zeke. I think that transparency is good, but we often see that transparency, even people don't shop for in many cases. But often people, when they do, they might gravitate toward a higher cost provider, thinking that that provider may provide better care. Yeah. So that's a thing as well, too. Transparency, I think it has value for sure, but it's certainly not a real fix to make sure that we have lower cost.
And so we're going to, unless you have something else to add, Marion, we're going to move on to the second big fix. Go right ahead.
Thank you so much. So one of the things I want to point out, another bipartisan thing I see happening in medicine, and keep in mind I'm a physician and I talk with other practicing physicians. You brought up the high cost model. So we saw a lot of Americans go towards concierge. In the last 10 years, there's been a new model emerging called direct pay care, DPC. Direct pay care is not concierge. It's a more of affordable direct pay model that's actually creating happy patients, happy doctors, really good access, saving patients from having to go to emergency rooms and other places. And I think one of the things that's really important about it is it's a model of transparency for outpatient care. We have hospitals that are single standing surgery centers. I've written about one in a piece that I did on price transparency. The Oklahoma Surgery Center, just to give a number, they were able to do for under $4,000 a tonsillectomy that was going to cost a patient, I think it was close to $70,000.
So there's a difference just even knowing.
Yes. So we might want to get used to shopping.
And we're going to move on to the next big fix because I want to make sure that
we have Zeke, time, yeah.
Yeah, Zeke Emanuel.
Good conversation so far.
Yeah, Zeke, you've been talking about these administrative costs, and you have a solution that would incorporate artificial intelligence. Lay out your big fix idea and the problem it seeks to solve.
Yeah, so we have a problem of, as we've said, too many prices and too much negotiation and a lot of time spent billing. One of the problems we have is we have a very complicated system of what we pay for and different things. You know, I just had a surgeon do something on one of my fingers, and to inject me for with the anesthesia to numb up the finger and then to cut in, two separate charges. Now, that wouldn't happen in most other places. And so we need to simplify that. And then you can use AI to simplify the coding. What actually is covered? What code should you put in? And also simplify the billing. We've got to get a system so not every insurance company has a different billing system. They won't like it. That's one of their tricks, going back. Lots of different tricks that they use. And that could dramatically simplify what we do. There are studies already where some of this has been put into place, and you can end up saving probably a quarter of what we spend
of
on
administration costs.
For
follow up to you real quick, though, because I do think this gets to a bigger question. So what we're talking about there is using AI to replace some tasks that humans are doing. Mm-hmm. And at this point, the whole American economy is so wrapped up in healthcare spending. I think right now healthcare is accounting for basically all of job growth in America, that if you start to chip away at things that look like bloat, could you also like sink the economy in the same time? I know we're just trying to solve healthcare today, not the economy, but how would you go about reducing costs in the healthcare system without endangering the whole, all the people that it employs essentially?
Well, look, there is going to be a transition. Yeah. If you want to reduce healthcare costs, you're going to get rid of some of those jobs, Ari. You can't.
Yeah, yeah. There's going to be a labor. There's going to be a labor cost to this.
There's going to have to be a transition.
Yeah.
But one of the things we've actually learned is that places where healthcare costs go up and therefore it employs more people actually leads to job decline in other areas of the economy because it's a cost.
Yeah.
So yes, there will be a transition between some people no longer being, you know, the paper pushers no longer being doing administrative jobs, but the savings will lead to people have more money, they'll spend it in other things, leading to more jobs. Companies will have more money, they'll either raise wages or spend it in more R&D or other things. So you actually increase the economic activity.
But it could be a painful transition.
They're always painful transitions. Yeah. And yes, you have to insure against those painful transitions. It's one of the reasons we have unemployment insurance, et cetera. So I totally agree with that. Let me just say one other thing. I think when we think about these big ideas, we need to think about two steps. we're not ready for comprehensive reform. We need comprehensive reform. Don't get me wrong. We need a very big idea. Even our ideas so far are not big enough for fixing the American healthcare system, in my opinion. But we're not there yet. We don't have national consensus about what that idea looks like. We don't have understanding of how it's going to impact the system. So we need to do some of these things, direct contracting, cutting administrative costs, and standardizing billing, all very important. They will save money in the short term. They're not actually long-term fixes. They will not transform the system and the insanity that
we have. This is low-hanging fruit, is what you're saying.
And Wendell, I saw your head nodding. You want to comment on this one?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Some of those jobs, by the way, should go away. So many of the people who work in hospitals, hundreds, in fact, do nothing more day in and day out but argue with and try to get the hospital, or if you're in a physician practice, the doctor is paid. There's even a job description called a denial nurse. And a lot of people who work for insurance companies do nothing more than second guess a doctor to say, no, we're not going to cover that. Even though it's a covered benefit under your plan, we don't think you that it's medically necessary or medically appropriate for you. So there are a lot of jobs that I think Americans would be happy to see go away.
Marion, do you agree? Do you feel like cutting administrative bloat and perhaps using technology to do so is a potential first step toward lowering costs here?
Oh, I will leave the using the AI to do it to someone else.
Yeah.
But there will be no greater champion for getting rid of administrative bloat than I. But I think what we really want to think about, you know, when I had my 30-year Duke reunion, and we heard from Dr. Bob Califf, and we had questions around this, and one of the things he said that stuck with me, and I loved it, was that people really still want someone to care for them for their health care. Mm-hmm. So when we're getting rid of jobs, I think we want to make – I think I'd actually – I'd argue that what we want to add – are the people that actually touch and see the patient.
Mm. So not necessarily maybe reallocating resources within the system for more personal care, less administration.
Well, look, one of the things...
More frontline, not as many administrators.
One of the things that using more AI to simplify and streamline the billing, coding and billing process reduces the paperwork that a doctor or nurse has to do on the coding and the billing.
Which means more time for patients.
Exactly. Yep. So one of the benefits is, yes, you'll reduce the number of people you need, but you will also free up time and therefore increase the productivity of doctors in terms of face-to-face patient care. And I think that's one of the advantages of focusing on administrative costs. But, you know, look, $250 billion of administrative savings is very big. Let me just say for the people listening, that's 5% of healthcare costs. This last year, healthcare costs went up 11%.
Yeah,
so it's no panacea.
Yeah, yeah. Understood. Yeah.
By the way, Gloria says we need Medicare for all, like many countries have. Get rid of for-profit insurance companies gouging us.
And we have a lot of callers, too. Yeah, we'd love to get to you on the other side of this break.
Yeah.
We're also going to get Wendell's first big idea, and we're going to hear a lot more from our guests, who are Wendell Potter, Dr. Zeke Emanuel, and Dr. Marion Mass. Keep those calls and comments coming. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The rates are too high. People are not getting coverage like they should. We should have free healthcare like other countries do.
I unfortunately can't get healthcare because I'm a DACA recipient. Yeah, I haven't had health insurance since I came here when I was 12 years old. So. Undocumented people should have free healthcare. Just because they're undocumented, that doesn't mean that they're not paying taxes.
You know, whatever I need, I can get through the VA. Yes, it's a shame it's not equal for anybody.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Eric, you just heard there from Allison, Yvonne, and Darian, who spoke to our producer, Andreas Copes, yesterday in Center City. We are talking this hour about our broken healthcare system, the spiraling costs, the uneven quality of care and access, worker shortages, on and on. It's the second episode in our Big Fix series, and we asked three experts to bring their ideas for fixing the healthcare system. We've been debating the pros and cons of those ideas. Let me reintroduce our guest. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is an oncologist and key architect of the ACA and vice provost of global initiatives at Penn. He's the author of the new book, Eat Your Ice Cream. Dr. Marion Mass is a practicing pediatrician in Bucks County and board member of Free to Care. And Wendell Potter is a former health insurance executive, president of the Center for Health and Democracy, and editor of the Substack, Healthcare Uncovered.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. We want your Big Fix ideas. How would you make healthcare better in America? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, keep those comments coming in the live chat. Tiffany from Philly's on the line. Tiffany, you're on Studio 2. What's your Big Fix?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been a nurse for over 20 years in the Philadelphia region, with most of my career being in emergency medicine. I actually left the bedside, even though I really didn't want to, because of private equity. I've worked for several hospitals in the area that have closed down because these private equity firms are taking over, they're buying up and bankrupting our small nonprofit community hospitals and closing them, leaving patients with no options. I think this is a real crisis that we need to look at and get private equity out of healthcare.
Thank you. That's Tiffany from Philly. We have Jameson from Chestnut Hill on the line. Jameson, you're on Studio 2. What's your Big Fix?
Hi, how you doing? I just think that all of these solutions are just adding so much more complexity to an already complex system. Why can't we just tell everyone that on January 1st, instead of sending the bill to the HMO, send them to the government? And then the HMOs are, I don't know, out of business, or go in, turn into like small boutique HMOs for the rich and whatever. Mm. And all the money that's going into the HMOs now, just redirect it to the government. Send the employer contribution, send it, make an employee tax. Nobody even has to really notice any disruptions in their paychecks. It just seems like there's all this Byzantine layers upon layers in this stuff. And really, at the end of the day, all we want is to go to the doctor and get healthy again.
Yeah, nationalize.
Good
the
call
system.
And good
great.
Word, by the way, Byzantine.
Yeah,
well
I like
done,
that.
Jameson. That's a great word. I think that does tee us up nicely mm-hmm. for Wendell's first big idea about creating a Medicare by choice program that would allow anyone to buy into the public Medicare program. So explain how that would work. And is it leading us toward this eventual nationalization, single payer endpoint? Go ahead.
It certainly could lead us in that direction.
Yeah.
But I think keep in mind that unless you are a senior, someone with disabilities, poor, or
veteran,
you don't have access to a public program. Why don't we expand that? Why don't we give people that opportunity? Keep in mind that when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, the House passed a version of that bill that included that choice, that public option. It was stripped in the Senate because it couldn't pass, because one senator said he wouldn't vote for it unless it was stripped out. So we missed that opportunity. I told the House Steering and Policy Committee that if they passed that bill without a public option, they might as well call it the Health Insurance Industry Profit Protection and Enhancement Act. And in many cases, that's true, because these insurance companies, like the ones I work for, have made enormous profits over the past several years. Mm-hmm. Why don't we look at revisiting that idea?
And so just to explain to folks how that idea would work in practice. So any person, any American, could opt into a Medicare-style program.
Would
it work?
Including employers, because employers these days are finding it very difficult to continue to offer coverage to their workers. In fact, small businesses, in many cases, just getting out of the game, they cannot do it. Give them an opportunity and give individuals the opportunity to do that. Zeke mentioned earlier that the exchanges that were created by the ACA, they're complicated. Let's simplify it. The Medicare program is very, very simple and has low overhead. Certainly my old industry will resist it, will work valiantly to try to keep it from happening. But it would be a way that would save families and individuals and businesses a lot of money. A small family, for example, if you pay $10,000 a year in health care, you could save, by our calculations, about $2,000 a year.
And so how would it be subsidized? So who would pay in? Would you sort of continue to pay like you normally pay through, you know, out of your paycheck? How would that the payment structure work?
Yeah, there has to be somebody to help subsidize it for most people. In this country, you cannot afford health insurance because it's so expensive. The average cost of a family policy now for it is $27,000. Employers subsidize it, and the exchanges, the government subsidizes. Somebody has to provide some help to let people afford coverage. And there would be a way that that could be implemented so that there could be some income-based or your financial ability to pay. Your premiums would be subsidized. But the premiums would be a lot less because mm-hmm. you are eliminating much of the overhead that is a part of private health insurance. One of the reasons I left the industry was because I saw how, even though I was trying to trying to tell people and did over the many years that private insurers were part of the solution, they actually contribute heavily to the cost and also to our healthcare system being as inequitable and unfair as it is.
Yeah.
I would love to get your thoughts on that, Mary, and the idea of the public option. Feels like we're reviving an old debate. I feel like in some ways I've traveled back in time. But, Marion, what are your thoughts on a public option, which is not quite like, you know, single payer, but it's feels like a step in that direction?
I'd still go back to my original tenet that we need a vigorous fiscal accounting before, just as you said, you know, we can't do anything big until we sit down, look at the system, dissect it. We're not going to have the opportunity to do that, nor should we. And I think that we have to have that big fiscal accounting first. The previous caller that talked about private equity coming into healthcare, whenever we've done things in healthcare to change something big, we end up with these unintended consequences. I mean, you brought up, you know, the ACA. We launched it. We did the exchanges. We actually expanded Medicaid to populations that couldn't get it before. In a way, they almost had the option to come in, like the public option to come into Medicaid if they were below a certain income level, portions of the population that couldn't had it before. And what happened? You know, I've read some of your writings where you talk about the companies in the Medicaid managed care market that became high, you know, profiting companies. We talked about these groups that are coming in and buying up hospitals, the private equity groups. I think we have to sit down and look at all the people that have been empowered by what we've had in place since Medicare, since Medicaid, since the ACA, and figure out before we do anything, like, how can we make sure we're not going to have more unintended consequences where we just watch that rise?
We figure out who's getting the money, where the bloat is.
Let's talk about the public option here as a potential solution.
Let me just say two words about private equity. One is the fact that private equity is coming in tells you that there's a lot of excess money there that can be wrung out.
Mm-hmm.
And they have figured out how to do it. And that's actually very important. That means we could save a lot of money. The second point is I think the studies are, and I've contributed some of them, are that there's no place that private equity has come in that it has actually made a big positive difference. Mostly it's made a big negative difference. And so I think you're seeing a lot of states wanting to restrain that. But that they're in is, I think, a very telling for all of us.
It's a symptom, you're saying.
But it's also an indication that there's money to be wrung out of the system if we can think of it right. So here's a simplified way of simplifying. I am not for the public option as a buy-in. I think we start with the fact that we have at least three exchanges going on at once, three marketplaces.
This is going into your second idea.
Yeah, my second idea.
Go right ahead.
So we have the exchanges. Everyone knows that.
Yep.
In Medicare, you also have exchanges. It's called Medicare Advantage. You get a selection in Philadelphia, I think. I can't remember the last number, but, you know, 20 or 30 different Medicare Advantage plans that you can choose from. Any single insurer like Wendell's old employer, Cigna, might have four or five of them in the marketplace in different ways. And then you have an exchanges, as mentioned, in Medicaid. You've got a lot of different managed care companies in various places running the Medicaid program. They do it. States have outsourced it for predictability about costs. That doesn't necessarily mean people. Put them all together.
One big marketplace.
Mm-hmm. One big marketplace. You've got where one of the options is traditional Medicare. I'm not actually a big fan of traditional Medicare as it is. I think it was designed in the 50s and it shows. But you can have a limited number, not on, You need competition, but you don't need unlimited competition. We know from behavioral economics, unlimited competition creates all sorts of gaming opportunities, all sorts of paralysis on people. They can't compare too many options. Limited competition, including local insurers, so the big nationals don't freeze everyone out. And you then put everyone, including the uninsured.
So everyone might have like six choices, and there would be
correct.
One place to
That's go
find
That's what I've written,
them.
Six choices. And the employers, you know, big employers, Comcast here, or University of Pennsylvania, they want to still provide their own their care in their own through their own mechanisms. They can do it. But everyone else, that turns out to be 50% of the population, everyone else is in this exchange. And, that's 160 to 80 million people in one exchange, and you standardize the benefits, you standardize the billing, you standardize things, and people then choose. You also standardize the copays and the deductibles, so you keep them
low. And this saves money because it gets rid of a lot of that administrative cost that you
Also gets rid of a lot of gaming, and it makes it a lot simpler to actually administer. You know, there are challenges with it. One of the other ideas I think that is important is if you have an exchange like that, you have to have people in the same insurance company or in traditional Medicare for a prolonged period of time. Mm. One of the problems with our system is
every year
we change. Yeah. And, you know, if you change from, you know, insurance company A to insurance company B, and then say in this new exchange you take Wendell Potter's Medicare, right?
Yeah.
There's no reason. I have absolutely no incentive to invest in your prevention because by the time I've invested, you're with someone else and it's irrelevant. Putting everyone in for a prolonged period of time changes the incentives dramatically.
I might try to keep you a little healthier because I don't want to have to.
So, exactly.
Let me ask then about this idea, Wendell, because I think what we're driving toward here is the idea that you can have a healthcare marketplace that people actually know how to navigate and that their choices in that marketplace are actually indicative of what they want and not just their glazed over confusion, which is how I feel picking right now.
Yeah.
Is that realistic? Can we get to a marketplace that actually functions like the supermarket where I actually know what I'm choosing between and I actually know the price of it?
I think you can.
Okay.
I think you need to simplify it. And again, the traditional Medicare program is quite simple. There are no networks. Almost every doctor and hospital in the country participates. There's not all that much prior authorization in traditional Medicare. It's rampant in private health insurance companies. People don't understand their out-of-pocket costs. They don't know, in many cases, the difference between a deductible and a co-insurance payment and a co-payment, and or how much they are going to be on the hook for, even if they pay a lot of money in premiums, how much they're going to have to pay out-of-pocket. People don't think about that. They think first and foremost are premiums. You need to simplify it. And I think, again, the idea that I have, Medicare by choice, would simplify, will remove a lot of that. It would also cap out-of-pocket costs and give people
wait a second, Wendell. First of all, Medicare does not cap out-of-pocket costs.
No, it doesn't yet.
And
exactly.
Second of all, you haven't mentioned at all that Medicare overpays for a lot of unnecessary care, a lot of inefficient care. It's not a perfect system.
But how about could you reform it, though?
But the Medicare Advantage program overpays a lot more. The MedPAC estimates that last year alone, the Medicare Advantage program, the private insurers were overpaid about $84 billion.
Look, I've written extensively on it. We could fix a big portion of that. Medicare hasn't fixed it by the way it pays. But I will say, you know, it's not like Medicare is an ideal system at all. It overpays, and a lot of it's hidden on the overpayment. Mm-hmm. And people get upset. Well, you know, I had to, in private insurance, I had to be prior authorized. Why do you have to be prior authorized? Because doctors often do unnecessary things. Doctors also do inefficient things.
But Zeke, you said just a few minutes ago yourself that in private insurance companies often pay more or get more, $2,000 more than the hospital charges. And you can look at the cost of prescription medications and see that the PBMs that these big companies operate, often the PBMs suck more money out of the pharmacy supply chain and make more money than certainly the pharmacist, but even the drug manufacturers.
And by the way, I want to bring in a caller because we're about to go to a break in about a minute and a half. We have Christine from Huntington Valley on the line who wants to talk about this Medicare issue. Christine, you're on Studio 2.
Yes.
What's your question or comment?
great. So, I just wanted to comment on that. It's Medicare is not that easy. I just had to do it with my dad. I'm not quite sure if any of the panelists have received Medicare, but picking the supplemental, I would say, why doesn't the government offer 100% policy and compete in the free market?
Agreed.
Secondly, I want to comment on the doctors being inefficient and ordering tests. You know, we have the lawyers up against us. Like, it's like defensive medicine. You know, we have to order these tests, God forbid, like we miss something and then we lose our license to practice. So I don't know. I kind of didn't like that ending comment that I just heard. But anyway, that's
thank
you, know,
you.
My
Christine
opinion.
From Huntington Valley. You like this idea, Wendell, that what she's saying, you agree with what she's saying, that Medicare is not very easy. There are some issues.
There are issues. And as Zeke said, there is no current out-of-pocket cap for traditional Medicare. You need to have a cap, and there is legislation that's been introduced that would do that. There actually is now a cap on prescription drugs in the Part D program, so that is a step in the right direction. But because there is no overall cap, people, if you are in traditional Medicare, you need to, or you should, if you can afford it at all, get a supplemental policy. It's confusing to try to figure that marketplace out. So the traditional Medicare program, I'm the first to say, needs to be addressed. There are some things, but on the other hand, it's a lot better than the other options that many people have.
Interesting. Okay,
not
so we have
talk about. Yeah.
A lot of callers, a lot of comments. We're going to try to get to as many of those as possible. We still have two big ideas lingering out there. We want to get to those too. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
It's not working for a large number of people, but if you have the funds, it works for you. We need to start putting caps on medications and pharmaceutical companies. It's all about money. That's it.
I recently was in Scotland and had to go to the emergency room. What I received as a foreigner worked for me, and it was fair and equal for all people in the UK and for Scotland.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Errant, those were the voices of Keisha and Armando, who spoke with our producer, Andreas Copes, yesterday in Center City.
It is The Big Fix today, our monthly series where we debate big ideas for solving the country's most stubborn problems. And today we've been talking about healthcare and how to make the system work better. We asked our guests to bring in two solutions, and we've been batting around their ideas. Let me reintroduce our guest. We have Dr. Zeke Emanuel. He's an oncologist, a key architect of the ACA, and vice provost for global initiatives at University of Pennsylvania. He's also the author of the new book, Eat Your Ice Cream. We have Dr. Marion Mass, a practicing pediatrician in Bucks County and board member of Free to Care. And last but not least, we have Wendell Potter, a former health insurance executive, president of the Center for Health and Democracy, and editor of the Substack Healthcare Uncovered.
I do love that book title, Eat Your Ice Cream, by
I
the way.
Do
That's
too,
a good one.
Yeah.
We want to hear from you as well. How would you make healthcare better in America? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Real quickly, going to squeeze in a couple callers. Jeff from Delaware, mm-hmm. You're on Studio 2. What's your idea?
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Simple idea. I feel like any kind of billing an insurance company is just wasted money. So I would like to see you be able to buy a membership to your local hospital. All the doctors would be on salary. They would have no billing. And then basically you would go in with whatever ailment you have, whether, you know, just simple doctor check-in or surgery, and they just would simply, you know, have notes of, you know, how much, what the procedures they did, but they wouldn't have to go through elaborate billing. And then you would just carry a small amount of insurance if you're for traveling outside your area. Mm. So like if you're in California and you need medical attention, you'd have a small policy for the times you're out of town.
Mm. Thank
right.
you so
Jeff
much.
From
Jeff
Delaware.
From Delaware. How about Susan from Mount Airy on the line, who's been with us for a bit here. Hey, Susan, thanks for being patient. You're on Studio 2. What's your comment or idea?
Hey, I like that last guy's idea. And I like what the nurse said. And these guests here, those doctors are scientists. They should not have to worry about money taking care of people. And good luck for you, Mr. Insurance Guy, former insurance guy. I mean, there is no, the putting money around people's health care, you're taking the rug out from under doctors and nurses. Get it? Should have had a nurse on the show instead of the insurance guy. Okay, that's all.
All right, Susan from Mount Airy.
We might need to clarify Wendell's bio a little bit there.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, okay. I am the former health insurance company executive. I worked in the industry for 20 years for Humana and then Cigna, but I became a whistleblower. I saw how these companies really operate.
Yeah, so that's why we wanted Wendell's perspective.
Wendell has ideas.
Thank you so much, though. You know, we'll always take advice on show format. We appreciate that. Okay, Marion, I want to get to your second idea now, exposing the profiteering of middlemen of suits.
Yeah.
Explain this one.
No, absolutely. And for the record, I like ice cream, and I actually really like Wendell. So, and I'm the one that's the practicing doctor here.
Go right ahead. Jump in, Marion.
So if you actually go on X, you can find my profile, and I'm my name, Marion Mass, and somewhere there on my profile it says scrubs, not suits. I think what we have to get back to the basics of is we need to preserve the people that are actually taking care of the patient. And I think that there's a lot of money floating around the system when we have someone else paying for every single part of the care. It was actually one of the problems that I had with the Affordable Care Act is that we had an insurance model where you had guaranteed things that must be paid for. Maybe there's people that don't want those things, right? But when you pay for every part of care through a third party, whether that be the government or a middleman or a PBM, and I'm really glad you brought them up because I've been writing about them since 2018. But when you pay that way, you end up wasting a lot of money.
And talk about the bloat. I want you to really kind of help people who are not in this healthcare maze or don't really understand how the sausage is made. How do these administrators really bloat the cost of healthcare?
Well, how? There's a lot of different
kinds of
administrators.
I know they got big salaries. Yeah,
sure, no. I mean, one thing that we've left out of the discussion has been the hospital bloat. And I'm an employed physician. I don't speak for the place that I work for, but you can take a look at the highest paid CEOs of hospital systems in the country, and you can find individuals making over $30 million a year. That's absolutely outrageous. We've referenced doctors doing unnecessary tests, lots of unnecessary tests happening. I agree. I think that's happening. Some of it is happening because they can. Some of it is happening out of the problem of fraud. But when we go back and we look at the hospitals, now I'm almost done paying for my third child through undergrad. The hospital curve of prices, it's outpacing college tuition. For everyone listening, that should be a big concern, right?
Yeah.
It's another reason that I call for transparency. And I think we have to take a look at these big C-suites, these big administrative suites. I'm not much of a price fixer, right? But I think that we have to look at how did the hospitals have so much money to pay for these things when we have a Medicare system that has left the doctors flat with reimbursement, but we're paying more to hospitals, and then it incentivizes the hospitals to get bigger and bigger. If we talk about breaking up big medicine, which is another thing that people talk about, and I'm not against that, we have to make sure that we don't leave a power vacuum where we have hospitals as the new Godzilla in the room.
Mm. You wanted to talk for your second idea, Wendell, actually about something that I think gets to this, and you wanted to focus on pharmacy benefit managers, right? That's PBMs. That's what we're talking about. That's been surfacing. So what you want to require structural separation of health insurance companies and PBMs from medical providers and pharmacies. What would that accomplish? And really, what is it? You have to explain the idea first.
Yeah. And over the past 10 to 15 years, we've seen enormous consolidation among health insurance companies and in health care broadly.
Yeah.
As the company that I used to work for, Cigna, has gotten more and more into healthcare delivery, the pharmacy benefit.
This is vertical integration.
It's vertical
integration,
exactly right. And PBMs are the entity in the pharmacy supply chain that few people know anything about, but it sucks so much money out of the pharmacy supply chain. People are paying a lot more for the prescription drugs because of the way that part of the industry has developed. Cigna now gets more of its revenue and profits from the PBM that it operates, which is called Express Scripts, which it bought in 2018, than it does in its health plans. And at CVS, which owns Aetna now, its PBM, Caremark, brings in more revenue and makes more money for the parent company than Aetna or 9,000 retail stores. And the same is almost true at United. Those three companies have PBMs that control 80% of the pharmacy's PBM
market. So how
would
you go about breaking this up? Is this a, like, legislation? What would
it is legislation. In fact, there is legislation that was introduced just earlier this month, a bipartisan bill by Senators Josh Hawley, a very conservative senator from Missouri, and Senator Elizabeth Warren, that would break up or make it illegal for big conglomerates to own an insurance company, a PBM, be deep into healthcare delivery. United Healthcare, by the way, now owns so many physician practices that it's become the biggest employer of doctors in the country.
10%.
How do we? And I'm curious, like, how we got here,
to
where
this place.
Where sort of people, one entity can control so many different sort of steps along the chain.
Well,
has the FTC been? United Healthcare, they have 2,700 subsidiaries. That's outrageous. Sorry.
So let's talk about how we got here. A lot of people, certainly 15 years ago when we were debating the Affordable Care Act, thought that Kaiser would be a good model. What is Kaiser? Well, Kaiser, you've got an insurance company that owns the hospitals, that owns the doctors, so they have an incentive to be efficient. Mm-hmm. They have an incentive to provide good care, et cetera, right? And some of us predicted that, in fact, we would get hospitals with doctors and they would become insurers. Like one of those people said, well, why don't I have a contract with the hospital? That what basically makes the hospital an insurance company for you. And we thought that would be a good thing. Well, the hospitals didn't do it, but it turns out the insurance company said, wow, that is a good thing. But, you know, if they're going to squeeze our profits on the insurance side, we could make more money
somewhere
by actually doing the providing, doing all of these other things. What we didn't do, and I think Marion made a good point, is we didn't enforce some restrictions on that. It's not, Kaiser doesn't do the PBM side. It doesn't do the nursing homes and other things that are provided by some of these large integrated companies.
That gets me another question, though.
But wait a second.
When you do the breakup, how do you ensure that in the vacuum that's created, someone else doesn't go in and do some other sort of consolidatory thing that it's just as bad or worse?
I agree with you. And you're getting to the point of unintended consequences that happen in many, many ways, partially because healthcare is so complicated.
Right.
One of the advantages, I do think, of simplification and standardization is you take out these niches where gaming is possible.
Yeah.
And I think that actually will reduce, it won't get rid of gaming. Gaming actually happens, you can go to any foreign system, there's gaming. But it will reduce the opportunity for gaming and reduce the amount of money that's being sucked out of the system for gaming. Let me say, with all due respect to my colleagues, one of the things I think this discussion is showing is we're not thinking fundamentally enough. We're not thinking big enough in terms. This healthcare system, you know, transparency, Medicare by choice, administrative savings, one big exchange, those are steps along the way, but they're not a big enough idea to fix a $5 trillion problem.
Real quick, what's a big enough idea? Because I think what you're saying, there's a whack-a-mole potential sort of
these little ideas, nothing big enough to deal with the whole enchilada.
I think that is exactly right. I do think we need, as I've said, I think step one is to create an exchange that everyone but the employer comes in, and employers could go in. I like Wendell's point on that. I totally agree with it. And then you do need to have, here's one insurance package. And here's the standard deductibles. Deductibles can't be more than $1,600, which is 2% of the average income in America. You have to have a limit on total out-of-pocket expenditures. You have to have the same billing for everything. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting to much more comprehensive reform that is going to be resisted mightily. And so we have to say, this is what we have to do for the American public. And everyone is going to lose something. And my actual view is, we also should think about, we're having a total budget. Here's the budget. We're not spending more than 17.5% on health care, no matter what.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to have to take a little bit of a haircut on that.
Yeah. And let me just say this. Matthew, listening from State College, says, such a productive conversation so far. I almost shed a tear in the first half because of the bipartisan hope it brings. What are we without hope?
Oh.
And this leads me to the question that I wanted to pose to all of you, because the shutdown seemed to put healthcare at front and center. And for a while, you know, I thought, you know, this is going to be the moment, right? And so I want each of you to take 30 seconds and just say, like, what do you think it'll take for us as an American people to have the big idea, to put the grit together, to push some kind of reform over the finish line? Are we at that moment?
And no, you need three things. You need everyone to agree on the problem. That we got. Everyone is on affordability. You need a plan that is sufficiently detailed that will actually get you to solve that. And then you need a political moment. I believe, personally, the political moment will be 2032, because we don't have enough of a plan. And by that time, we'll have a plan.
That's specific. I like that.
It's a presidential election year.
Marion, I'm going to argue that we can't wait until 2032.
Yeah.
Because I see people suffering now. And I see people not able to access care now. And I see doctors leaving the system now. I see nurses leaving the system now. I see pharmacists leaving the system now. I'm actually going to dial back. I know it's a big fix discussion. I love the idea of breaking up big medicine, but I think also preventing steering where companies do self-deal so that they can't steer in and among themselves. Yeah. And I will say that when you already have something that's proposed and bipartisan, it's something you got to jump on. Pharmacists Fight
and
Back Act.
We'll give you 10 seconds.
And that's true, because I'm seeing more bipartisan agreement on some fixes than I've ever seen before, certainly before, much more than we saw when the ACA was being debated.
Yeah.
We've got Democrats and Republicans agreeing on a lot of things in Washington these days.
So this could be the moment. Yes, we'll see.
I got to thank you guys. This was such a frothy and interesting conversation.
I know.
Randall Potter, thank you so much for your time. Dr. Marion Mass, thank you for your time. Dr. Zeke Emanuel, thank you for your time on Studio 2.
Yes.
Thank you.
And we got to say thank you to Dr. Christensen and Susan. Thanks to Maria, Rick, Pauline, Sandy, all on the line. Thank you so much for calling in. Sorry we couldn't get to you. And by the way, we couldn't do what we do without our producers. Shout out to Debbie Builder, because this big fix was her idea. Thank you for that, Debbie. Also, thank you to our producers, Andreas Copes and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.